the shirt?
I mean, if it was me, had that been me, I might have chosen differently. Maybe.
Like,
but it's all right. You're going through your Marvin Gaye phase.
I'm going through my Marvin Gaye phase. Like, that's the excuse that I'm using. This is the Marvin phase. This is just what it is. This is the shirt unbuttoned, the denim shirt unbuttoned to your navel. Responsible cocaine use phase.
I think you need to be Latino for how many buttons you have undone.
You said I'm official. I think it's only two.
No, if you got three,
yeah,
then you need to be speaking a lot more Spanish.
Fuck.
And it's allowed.
Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit subscribe and don't forget to hit that notification bell so you're alerted whenever we go live. We're constantly adding cross streams with other channels and adding new shows. Speaking of shows, yesterday was a bit of a busy day for me as I started off the day, the morning, being a guest on The Sublation Show with Doug Lane and Ashley Frowley, where we discussed my latest article for Sublation Magazine. Stakes is high. Addicted to the spectacle. That talk continued into their patron-only Parrot Room, where I pushed back a little bit on Doug Lane and his... I don't know. I don't want to say him going down a rabbit hole, but his concern for the state's involvement in suppressing free speech. And then that evening, I concluded with being the guest host for Give Them an Argument with Ben Burgess, where we kind of continued the talk that we were having on Sublation and talked about the sad public deaths of Jordan Neely and Banco Brown. And then I opened up the phone lines for the Give Them an Argument audience. Definitely several people called. We actually had to not take a call because we went over their allotted time. So all that is up. Please check that out. Also, as a bonus for TIR patrons, I was allowed access to the GTAA post game. So if you're enjoying what we do here and want access to that post show and all of our post show champagne rooms, past and present, there's only one way: become a patron. And Patreon is finally allowing me to do a free trial. Yes, that's right. For 7 days, you can have access to champagne rooms, past and present. Join us for movie night this week. Send messages directly to the crew. Go to patreon.com/bitterlakepresents and sign up. Wherever you are listening and watching, there are links in the description. For as little as $3 a month and $30 a year, it can all be yours. You can also be part of the live audience of the Mau Mau Mau, the Mau Mau Mau, the Mau Mau Hour. After this show, speaking of champagne rooms, MT Toussaint and I are going to be doing a fun breakdown of my new favorite rapper I came across on Instagram. I don't know if this one is better than the breakup heater of the year, Harry Potter, but it's a doozy. And before I bring in our guest and MT, I have a couple more quick announcements. Next Wednesday will mark the return of the man of the Mau Mau Hour, the Pascal Robert. Thank you, everyone, for all of your well wishes, prayers, and overall positivity. Pascal will be back and in rare form, and we'll be taking calls for that. And the only way you can be a part of that live audience of the Mau Mau Hour and get your calls taken is to become a patron. So might as well sign up because it's free. And finally, we have to say a fat, giant happy birthday to everyone's favorite Death Star middle manager, Deep State Cuba. Happy birthday, Cuba. We wish we could be with you in the deep vastness of space, torturing Ewoks, celebrating this day with you and a bunch of, maybe subparly trained stormtroopers. But have a good one, you and the missus. That being said, let me bring in the faceless voice of reason, the one and only M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello.
How are you?
Why, it's as if I've been with you here the whole time.
Listening in.
Listening in.
Being a creep. Just being a creep, being an overall creep.
Well, good at it.
Teasing me about my Marvin Gaye phase.
Yeah.
I mean, it's part of the mustache phase of my life.
I'm glad the handlebar's gone. That was the Harry Blackman candy phase.
The handlebar is kind of like the mullet of mustaches, right? There's a lot of party on the side with the business in the front. When you get rid of the handlebars, you're letting people know that you're a very, very serious porn star.
Wow, that explains the buttons.
I told you. Just got too buff for this shirt.
Sure.
You know what's kind of awesome? Something happened with my system and I can't see the chat.
Really?
I'm really happy about that because God knows. Oh.
Autumn Leaves said he found a doom metal band from Mexico City called Terror Cosmico.
Actually, I know a pretty decent doom metal band from Juarez.
Really?
Yeah, I've been kind of wanting to go check those guys out. I've been kind of wanting to go to like mainland. I call it main. I don't. They call it the South here, which is anywhere in like mainland Mexico. Mm-hmm. I've been kind of wanting to go over there and see some friends and.
South side.
That's how I feel about Cabo, because Cabo is the south of the state.
Okay.
I wanted to drive all the way down there just so I could see sunshine, because it's been so overcast out here, and I saw that it was even foggy in Cabo.
See.
What is going on, dude? What did you do? I blamed Ben, actually, when he left, right before he left. I was like, you came here with your Eeyore energy, and you brought all this fucking fog
to this man. Beautiful
sunny place.
He's already down and you just kicked him.
And he said, well, I'm gone now. And I'm like, yeah, and it's still here. That's how strong the energy was.
He's still on the ground covering himself with his blazer and you're still kicking him.
With his blazer. I think it was on Ben's show. I said something about people think he's got a Gucci blazer. I don't know why. They think the same blazer is like 12 different blazers.
It's Tom Ford. Excuse you.
Tom Ford. They think Ben is Jonah Hill.
Just hopped off Tom Ford with his Tom Ford blazer.
They think he's got like a fucking rollie on. Not even set at the right time. He's like, I'm just so rich, it doesn't bother me. I don't understand how anybody can assume that. I mean, he wears, you know, a Rolling Stones t-shirt.
He has a Patek Philippe watch.
He's got a protection neck watch.
A protection neck watch. He's got a Swatch watch.
Dude, those things are expensive now.
That's why he has one. That's why
I need to switch his faces on him. Like, it's like, eh. Were you on the show that day that Stefan was trying to fix his watch on the camera, but it looked like he was doing that old rapper thing where he was on the he was trying to fix his watch on the camera. I was like, Stefan, why you look like Puffy in 1998 right now?
So funny.
This shiny ass Casio. Okay, are you ready for this very serious show?
Very, very serious show. It's going to be fun, though, because learning is fun and thoughts are fun. It's a party of thoughts. He's laughing.
I can't see because I'm in the script page. So,
okay.
In 2016 and in this 2020 presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders brought language back in the United States lexicon that was deemed anachronistic political discourse. Socialism and Marxism were being seen now as viable strategies to fight off the perniciousness of neoliberal capitalism. In both runs, there was a push against the Sanders campaign that said it lacked a black agenda. In his first run for office, he was stopped mid-stump speech by BLM complaining about his quest for Medicare for all and return to Keynesian New Deal reforms not being black enough. Do you remember that?
I do.
BLM is an organization that is viewed by many in the public as the anti-carceral, anti-policing division of the left. Coming to prominence after the tragic killing of Trayvon Martin, they've been at the forefront of the protest movement to defund and in some cases abolish police. But after all their awareness raising around the policing issue, where are we now? Our guest Cedric Johnson in his latest book attempts to ask that question from his book, After Black Lives Matter. Given the sheer scale, magnitude, and diversity of 2020's resurgent Black Lives Matter protests, many pundits, scholars, and activists celebrated the George Floyd rebellion as a historic watershed, one where the possibility of real reform came into view. For too many, however, the euphoria of the moment suspended any critical analysis of what it all meant. This is a deeper problem on the U.S. left. The tendency to read protest as always prefigurative rather than contingent, and as a manifestation of real power rather than a reflection of potential. Such wish fulfillment thinking, however, forgets that mass mobilization is not the same as organized power, and that mass mobilization is much easier now with the endless opportunities for expressing discontent provided by social media, online petition, memes, and vlogging. The scale of protests can be misleading, and their actual effectiveness, regardless of their size, is dependent on historical conjunctions, such as the balance of political forces, the organized power and capacity of opposition, and the clarity of objectives among activists. Throughout the opening decades of this century, ever larger protests have proved incapable of consolidating in a manner that might effectively oppose ruling class prerogatives. In recent memory, we have witnessed successive mass protests, turn of the century demonstrations against global capitalism, protests against the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, Occupy Wall Street encampments, anti-eviction campaigns, the March for Our Lives following the Parkland High School mass shooting, protests against police violence and ICE deportations, among others. But these have done little to depose capitalist class power and the advancing neoliberal project. If anything, the hegemony of finance capital, the war-making powers of the national security state, the criminalization of immigration, the power of the gun lobby, and the unaccountability of police are as entrenched as ever. That was from my friend and professor and author, the reason why Teray Reed comes on this show, the reason why Pascal Robert is my co-host. It all starts with this man right here. Please welcome Cedric Johnson. So
great to be here, man.
Very, very happy to have you. Thank you for taking the time to be here. I'm excited. You got the preview of this book. I actually went and bought it today. I bought
the Thanks, e-book. Appreciate you.
I bought the ebook today.
All right.
Where's the receipt? And,
oh wow, you're gonna be one of you're really gonna be
Yeah, I mean that's how these conversations go. Just,
you hit me with this, huh?
We're coming for you, nigga.
That's what you hit me with.
We just started. You can't play that. Well, shit.
That's what you're gonna hit me with. I've been on white people shows all day yesterday. And then you're gonna N-word me like that in front of company.
Right.
That's why you got beat as a child.
Oh. Ouch.
But Cedric, despite MT's comments, we both enjoyed your book. And I will pass on Pascal, who actually wrote the blurb from TIR. Also was a fan of your book. We appreciate the shout out. Someone sent me a picture of it the other day. They said, oh, I just bought Cedric Johnson's book. I think they saw that you were coming on the show and they like got the book and they said, oh, I see you guys are mentioning it. Da-da-da-da. So I was like, oh, hell yeah.
It's been like what? 3 years?
Yes.
Since I first appeared.
It's yes.
Been a while. Yeah,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. Back in the day. And we were talking about BLM in your first appearance. It was one That's of the right. first I cut was us talking about, you know, what did lead to those things, because I felt then and still feel now that those things didn't happen in a vacuum. You know, there was a lot mm-hmm. that was going on, and you definitely mm-hmm. talk about that in depth in your book. And I mentioned this to you before the show in a text message, that in reading this book, and I'm also reading another Mike Davis book at the same time. He's an author I admire. It felt like there was moments of it where I felt like I was reading parts of City of Quartz. Especially when he talks about the carceral state. I think you examine that with a very, very sober lens. And, you know, also we mentioned James Forman locking up our own. I think mm-hmm. we even mentioned it the first time you were on the show. I think you went even deeper than where that book goes in certain regards. And Toussaint even called me earlier today. She goes, I really like this book.
I don't do that much.
So wherever you guys are listening or watching the show, there should be links in the description. I believe someone is probably putting links in the chat. Is that right, too, MT? Because I can't see it.
Someone can put links in the chat in a moment.
Does so name we can this? Do that. Now, Cedric, there has been some criticism about the book.
Right.
You had a really kind of large write-up in the New Yorker. I'm sure when you wrote the book, you knew you'd face some harsh criticism. Right. When you shared with me a while back that review in the New Yorker, it felt it was a bit heavy-handed in its critique towards the end of the review. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it kind of glorified the protest movement from almost a baby boomer type nostalgia. Mm-hmm. What is your response to the critics of your work?
I mean, so there's probably two main lines of criticism so far, right? You know, when you look at the piece by J. Caspian King, which I liked, right, for the most part, towards the end, he basically returns to 2020 and seems to suggest that I haven't really wrestled with those contradictions, right? That I haven't really thought through the impact and the power of 2020 and what it means, and that we simply can't turn away from it, right? That was something that people said to me and to Ray in the heat of the 2020 George Floyd rebellion. And you know, basically saying that if you're going to criticize Black Lives Matter, now's not the time to do it, right? You shouldn't do it now because look at what's happening in the streets. This is significant. This is the largest mass protest that we've seen in the history of the country. And so if you're going to try to be critical of it, you know, you're just out of step, you're tone deaf, you're not paying attention to what matters. It was interesting to hear the New Yorker review kind of echo that same sentiment, because we've had 3 years to think about this, right? And we've witnessed some changes that have taken place, no doubt, right? A lot of legislation, I think, just in the first year after George Floyd, 140 pieces of legislation at the state level across the country, right? You know, that was enacted. So,
but how much of that legislation is titular? I mean, how much of it is really substantive legislation? I mean, I know California's had the chokehold, for example, outlawed since what, 82?
Right.
And the big George Floyd crime bill that Congress sets forth. And I know you're talking about state legislation, which is very different from federal. But that big sweeping legislation that was a response to this moment was like, we're going to federally outlaw chokeholds. But I think outside of Eric Garner, who died in a chokehold?
There's been other people who've died in them, I think. But the to your point, though, right? You know, the rates have remained the same in terms of civilians who've been killed by police, you know, since 2020. You see roughly around 1,100 people a year who are killed by police. So whatever legislation was passed, it hasn't necessarily made an impact on that, you know, which we would hope for. But some gestures, I mean, I'm always careful to not say nothing has happened, because the things that have happened, it may take a while for them to actually have an impact. So, you know, just seeing some departments begin to experiment with mental health crisis units instead of having armed officers respond to different emergency situations, I think that's progressive, right? Even if we don't see the impact of it right now, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, depending on what phase they're in, it can make a difference, right? So I'm all in favor of that. But I just thought it was wild that Kang would return to that, you know, the 2020 election, and I mean 2020 protests, and talk about that as if be enamored by it. We shouldn't be in a different critical mode in terms of thinking about what's happening now, right? And why haven't we seen reductions in the levels of police violence against civilians in the intervening years? So that was a problem. The other pushback I've gotten, and I don't know if you've seen some of this stuff as well, mainly on Twitter and in the, you know, the dark wet parts of social media where people like to fester and criticize. People who haven't read the book, but who are upset that I would dare take up Black Lives Matter in a critical way, or dare to say that abolition as an ideology and as a political project may not be what we need, and maybe actually out of step with what the vast majority of Americans want and need at this particular moment. So the book has been condemned in those corners for ideological reasons. And also, I think, because I'm not a part of those academic cliques, just to be honest. I don't go to their conferences. I'm not invited to be on their panel discussions. I'm not on their dissertation committees. And so therefore, I'm an easy target, somebody who they can take out on social media in a couple of hot takes without even having read the book.
Do you think it's because you're Black?
Look, if it's not because I'm Black, it's offensive to me because I'm Black, right? Because it's been 30 years since I started grad school, right? I started grad school fall of 1993 at Ohio State. Mm-hmm. And if the thing that you would want to do as a grad student that would completely disqualify you and get you pushed out of the program, it would be to speak up about a book without having really read it carefully, right? And so sheer hubris that you see in some of these social media contexts where people are willing to condemn, to revile, without even having any sort of knowledge of the actual argument. To me, it's just, as an old-fashioned guy, right, it's anti-intellectual, and, you know, it's petty, and it's whack, right? I mean, that's the best I can say about it. It's fucked up. Look, to be honest,
we are in the era of engagement, Sid, and this is not cancel culture, but I want to speak to the manager culture. You definitely
have a lot of cats
that want to speak to the manager. You wrote this book. In the book, you say.
But I knew that was going to happen, right?
Well, yeah, that's, you know, I think you and Teray, you know, recently we had Paul Prescott on the show, and we did a show about the GI Bill, and he wrote a paper about it. And it felt like a lot of the comments from a clip that I cut. And sometimes, I'll be honest, I try to have incendiary titles for these clips as clickbait.
Sometimes it works.
And Gene Bajelon actually has more fun making clickbait titles because he's way better at it than me. And I think he changed the title up slightly, but I think it was just like, I think it was reparations or a dead end, which is a quote from Paul, but it's taken totally out of context. And right there, it's almost like that made that thing show up in the algorithm of everyone that's got an.
Oh man, you're chumming the waters, right?
Yeah. It's
like, you're throwing the fish guts and the blood in the water.
It's like everybody with an onk in their profile. I'm getting yelled at, and I don't understand reparations. One person said, "Who I thought this was the most beautiful thing, that reparations is not a racial project." It's interesting. Very interesting that you said that, especially in the context we were speaking in.
Well, you shouldn't talk so fast, man. I'm waiting for my check. Legislation goes through.
Well, that's why you're staying in California.
Shut your mouth, man. Exactly, right? That's why I moved here.
It's so funny. You know, me, Cedric, Teray, Pascal are in a group chat, and they never share news from California. These Negroes have been sharing this reparations news like they're watching the goddamn OJ trial.
Right. More exciting than the white Bronco.
when Gavin Newsom brings that check down, Cedric finna be like Sister Act 2. Oh, happy day. Back to the more serious matters. Cedric, in your book, you say anti-policing struggles must ultimately transcend the innate liberalism and ethnic politics of Black Lives Matter, which are political dead ends too easily usurped by the investor class and mainstream party politics, and instead directly address the underlying capitalist class contradictions that are driving police killing and America's overgrown carceral apparatus. Mm-hmm. The book, The New Jim Crow, as well as the 13th documentary frame and the 13th Amendment, also in the 13th documentary, framework have become commonplace in any discussion around the carceral system. Mm-hmm. A book that we have both referenced, Locking Up Our Own, tells a more detailed story without the fiery image of neo-slavery. Mm-hmm. What does The New Jim Crow and the powerful 13th documentary miss in their analysis of the carceral state?
Well, let me say something before I do that, which is, you know, and I'm sure, you know, you can recall this as well, right? During the late Reagan Bush period, right? The first response we get, the first analysis of the carceral expansion comes from Black civil rights organizations, right? And there's a lot of different reasons for that, right? Part of it has to do with where some of the most well-publicized incidences of police violence are coming from. Right. So if you think about Eleanor Bunkhorst in New York City or Malice Green in Detroit, right? When those people are killed in ways that we see as being unfair by police, the immediate groups that respond, or civil rights organizations, local activists, clergy, and what they do is they do what they've been doing, right? They simply frame those murders as an extension of the Jim Crow system that we thought we had left behind. Right. They use that language when they're talking about it. And it's a powerful language. Right. I mean, you know, I was a teenager during the 1980s. And if you ask me back then how I explained, you know, all of those incidents, I would say this is racism, right? Because I didn't have any other reference points. I didn't live in white neighborhoods or communities. And so I would respond the same ways. You also had hip hop music at that time, which amplified that sort of race analysis of what was happening. Mm-hmm. And what we should know by now, if we take a longer view, right? I mean, there were whites who were being killed by police back then as well, but they didn't have the same advocacy networks or apparatus in place to deal with those sorts of police killings. And so it took a lot longer for us to, you know, to catch up, I think. And in a way, we still haven't caught up, right? We're still using the same frames, even though the reality looks very different, right? So what New Jim Crow gets wrong, what Black Lives Matter gets wrong, is that once we leave the urban theater, the numbers change, right? Blacks are, in any given year, a minority of those persons who are killed by police, right? And so it begs other questions. Why are people in general being killed by police? What are these different civilian police conflicts like? And it also misses who the victims are if we're just talking about Black people, right? Because they're not the same, right? We're not talking about members of the Black middle class by and large. We're not necessarily talking about Black wealthy people, but we're essentially discussing the most vulnerable elements of the Black working class who are being routinely targeted by police for harassment and in many cases involved in fatal conflicts with police. So I think that's what's missing, right? It doesn't even the Black predicament, right? If we're talking Jim Crow or Black Lives Matter rhetoric, right? It essentially gives us the sense that any one of us can be stopped, harassed, and killed by police in any given moment. And that's just not the truth. That's just not the case, right? I mean, think about the some of the most high profile cases, right? Mm-hmm. George Floyd. Let's take George Floyd, Eric Garner, who you've already evoked, Alton Sterling, and Freddie Gray as some examples, right? Mm-hmm. If we look at these people as individuals, who were they? What were their lives like? Right? They weren't bankers. They weren't college graduates who were working as part of the professional managerial stratum. They were people who were struggling to try to eke out an existence in the economy that doesn't necessarily meet the needs of people who are less educated, who are lower skilled, and who would have been absorbed in an earlier period of, you know, high level manufacturing production in the country, but are not anymore. Right? So, you know, what was George Floyd doing in Minneapolis, right? He had moved there as part of a ministry that was about relocating men who were in recovery to help them put their lives back together and find gainful employment. And he had done a lot of different kinds of jobs, right? He'd worked as a security guard. I don't even know if I should say this, but he had also been involved in, you know, he'd been a rapper for a little while. He'd also been involved in a little bit of sex work. And so there's different things that happened and that he did. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that not to impugn him, but just to situate him as a person, right? Who is like millions of other people who are trying to eke out an existence. Eric Garner, same thing, selling, you know, Lucy's in front of a convenience store, a bodega in Long Island, right? Alton Sterling, selling, you know, pirated CDs or used CDs in front of a gas station in Baton Rouge. And Freddie Gray, like a lot of people, was involved in, you know, regular, you know, drug dealing, which, again, not trying to impugn him at all. It's actually a really pretty grotesque aspect of our society where I've got 3 cannabis dispensaries within walking distance of my house here, mm-hmm. but people in my home state of Louisiana are still being arrested for cannabis possession and distribution. I mean, that's just a gross injustice. But again, I think we need to focus on who these Black people are who are being targeted on a regular basis. I mean, I've been stopped by police many times before. I've been harassed before. I've been handcuffed. So I've had those experiences, but it doesn't happen to me on a regular or weekly basis as it does with many working class and largely unemployed and underemployed Black country. It's a long response to what you're saying.
No, we like long responses. That was awesome. Very thorough. How do you feel about the example of racism given by some particularly Black men with money who talk about being pulled over in the fancy car in certain neighborhoods?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it happens, right? You know, and I'm saying this because I'll just give a vague reference to it. In the last month, I've dealt directly with two young men who I'm connected to, my own son, but also the son of a longtime friend of mine who've had run-ins with police, right? And, you know, without going into all the details, it can happen to people who are upwardly mobile. It can happen to people who are in, you know, have a different class position. I think the way to explain that, and Toure is great with this, right? He actually says that the Black middle class tends to be collateral damage, essentially, in a strategy that's mainly trained working class and underemployed and unemployed people, right? It's not necessarily something that we're going to confront and face every day. And this is another part that James Forman Jr. brings into focus. Once either of us gets caught up in it, right, those of us who have means, we can hire a lawyer, right? We can figure out ways to work in the system to reduce the consequences of an arrest, even if we're guilty, right? If it's a DUI, if it is possession of
you can pay for a DUI.
Amounts of drugs. Yeah.
It's very different. Yeah.
Right. You're in a different situation than somebody who comes in unable to pay for basic fines and fees that the court may level against them, let alone be able to hire their own private lawyer. So when I hear people make those cases, and the one that folks always used to like to use was Skip Gates, right, being harassed in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Skip Gates is not going to go to, he's not going to go to jail overnight. He's not going to go to prison for life. Because he has the resources and the notoriety and the social networks and the power to avoid, you know, being processed by the system in that particular way. I mean, what happens? People always lop off the consequence of it, right? Skip Gates gets into a conflict with the police. He doesn't get shot. He ends up having a beer conference with the president, right, as a result of it. So right. It's just not a good, it's not a good example to use. But it doesn't stop people from using it, right? From sort of using this as a way of bringing us back to a conversation about this being primarily about race and racism.
Well, they say it's just systemic. I mean, again, the comments that we got from the show about the GI Bill was like the negation of racism being this system. And, you know, one thing I did learn from Toure when his students, you know, say that to him, he goes, well, what's the function? Right. And generally the answer is going to be, well, white supremacy.
Right.
Which has actually happened. And, you know, someone has said that in our comments before. And I asked that same, what's the function? And their answer was the white supremacy, which is ultimately the devil made me do it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, for me, and again, this is coming from a social science background. If something explains everything, it doesn't explain anything. And it's not helpful intellectually, right? I mean, that's the definition of a tautology, right? If it explains everything there is, which is how people use white supremacy, then it doesn't help me to understand what's going on in the society. It doesn't help me to understand why I had to step over a white guy on the sidewalk today as I was trying to get back to my apartment, right? White supremacy doesn't explain that for me.
Well, that's his own failure. That's where it's like the game of intellectual.
He didn't take advantage of white supremacy,
right? The game exactly. of intellectual twister people play. They go, everything that you don't like is white supremacy, right?
Right.
So, you know, getting messed with by a police officer is white supremacy, and yada 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 yada. You know, it's always wealth gap numbers, right? White supremacy. Right. But then when I say, well, the majority of people that I deal with in the homeless shelter are white. And, right. you know, I've spent way too much time outside of major metropolitan areas in the United States. And a lot of those poor people that I met were literally white.
Right.
And they did not like fucking with the police.
Right.
And they didn't like, you know, it was just like hanging out in the hood that I grew up in. But they seem to be failures of some kind. And then it's like, well, they have white supremacy too, but they just don't let it work for them. So it's almost like, oh, so underclass ideology for white people in the middle of the country, mm-hmm. and everybody else is just white supremacy. So it doesn't have to die
right.
in the thought process.
Yeah, and even like if you think back to, you know, the brutal beating of Tyre Nichols, right, which I mean, I stopped watching some of those videos just because it's just upsetting, right?
Good.
And I watched so many in trying to finish this book, you know, and read about, like, you know, read the police reports and read detailed, you know, eyewitness accounts of what happened in some cases. You can only stay in that space for so long. But look at the response to that, right? I mean, it was almost the same response we heard when Freddie Gray was detained by, you know, black cops, mm-hmm. driven around Baltimore, and he receives mm-hmm. injuries in the midst of his transport. With Tyre Nichols, I mean, you know, you're watching these black men beat this other black man to death, right? And we know now that his death was caused by blunt force trauma to his head. I mean, I'm not using white supremacy to explain that, right? I mean, who does that?
Well, you know, they have internalized racism, Cedric.
That's yeah, whatever. I mean, right. Right.
Duh.
But I'm just thinking, like, we've been in situations like that where, you know, whether it's a barroom where somebody's fighting, where it's, you know, when I was a kid in school, I mean, people would fight. It would be pretty vicious, or a domestic violence situation. I mean, where does the responsibility of these persons come into play? And why do we have to use, you know, internalized racism, the acrobatics of it, to make sense of what these people did? They behave the way other police officers behave sometimes, right? And they should be held accountable for that. There's no need to explain it by a retreat to internal racism. It just doesn't help us. I mean, they were engaging with who they believe to be some sort of ne'er-do-well mm-hmm. In the way that they always do, right? Which is to arrest, to detain, to harass, to treat with impunity, and to expect, you know, the fact that they have the legitimate use of power on their side to allow them to get away with it, right, in this case. So I just think, you know, it's just not helpful, right? The whole internalized racism, it's just acrobatics, and it doesn't illuminate the problem, as far as I'm concerned. Because here's the thing, right? So if we rely on racism as the explanation, it lets a lot of white people off the hook.
Ooh.
You know, because it always becomes this third person narrative. It's these people over here. Mm. It's the racist cops. It's Derek Chauvin. It's these other people, you know, Jason Van Dyke, who are the problem. It's not us. It's not those of us who rely on police protection and the reduction of petty crimes as a way of shoring up our real estate values.
Mm.
You know, people don't even think about that connection in most cases. And whites who enjoy, you know, and blacks as well, defined parts of cities, who enjoy robust tourist zones in cities, all of those things are made possible by way of policing, right? But, you know, for a lot of people, it's much more easy to think about, well, it's these cops over here. It's either the black cops who've internalized racism, it's the rogue cop, you know, Mark Furman, Derek Chauvin, whoever else, they're to blame, right? And we need to rid our society of those persons versus reorganizing the society in such a way that nobody deserves to be harassed in that way for selling cannabis. I mean, what the fuck? Or selling CDs,
mm-hmm.
right? Selling Lucy's, engaging in sex work. These things should not be criminalized forms of work to begin with. And so I think there's a different perspective that we should take. And there's some Black Lives Matter activists who are saying this. I don't want to act mm-hmm. like I'm the only person who's making this point.
It's funny you talk about that. I was actually having a conversation about somebody here where I live in Mexico. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the fact that you don't get a lot of petty theft crime because the economy here is based around tourism. And you will get messed up by law enforcement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there is no, and it's not pretty.
The law enforcement, they want the petty theft, right?
I mean, if that's the way you want to go, and it may not be just them. There's a lot of people that
I shouldn't say that. I still want to come down there. I probably yeah, I mean, you can. So loud. I mean, they're
like, look, if that's the way you want to go, it may not be the cops that mess you up. It may be somebody else. Like, it's quiet right. here. We like it that way. We can't have
right.
trouble. What is your problem with defunding the police? Is it a dead-end strategy, or is it a simple hashtag that lacks nuance and is antithetical to large-scale coalition building? I'm asking the question. I don't have the answer.
Yeah, so this was another bone of contention with some abolitionists who have a problem with that part of the argument. I do, you know, in the book, there's moments where I say, hey, some departments should be right-sized, right? You know, there's no real correlation between the funding levels of the Chicago Police Department and the results that we get as citizens in Chicago, right? I mean, Chicago has higher rates of homicide and violent crime than New York and Los Angeles, right? And it has a bigger police department in some regard, certain metrics, than those places. So I don't think that is the way to go, right? I think we can reduce crime through other means. So I am in favor in part of some defund arguments. The problem with it as a slogan and as a way of talking about the direction of Black Lives Matter or carceral reform, most Americans don't agree with that, right? And I'm not saying that to dismiss the claim, but if you want to have a political impact, you should at least be thinking about, you know, how are you going to build on this? How are you going to get people to follow you? And if most Americans are saying, look, they don't like what happened to George Floyd, they don't like seeing, you know, viral videos of police killings, but they're also, when you look at most public opinion polls, not willing to support reductions in their police budgets, that's a conundrum for organizers, right? That's a conundrum for advocates of defund. And it's one that they need to wrestle with as opposed to just simply balking at it and condemning anybody who would bring it up as an issue. I mean, that's real politics to be able to say, how do we build a popular constituency? How do we get people to join our side, right? So there's that dimension of it. More broadly, I'm more opposed to the idea of abolishing police, right? And I know that's a controversial position for some people to take. The reason I say that is I can't think of a socialist country. Maybe you can. Maybe some of the people in the chat can think of it. Can you think of a socialist country that did away with its military and its police?
Nope. Right? There are police in Cuba. Soviet Union had police.
Right. Can we think of a modern society that's as populous as ours, right? Mm-hmm. That's as complex as ours, that does away completely with law enforcement? And how do you have a society with the rule of law without law enforcement, right? I mean, that's a problem that I think some people, and this, again, I haven't talked to all abolitionists. I've had some who are students, some who are colleagues, some who are comrades, friends, family members. But it's a position that they don't quite think through carefully, right? How do we transition to the society we want without having a rule of law and without having law enforcement as part of that formula, right? And so in that regard, I'm more of a socialist who believes in the use of the state as a means of transition. I know that's unpopular in some corners now. People are committed to democratic socialism or maybe even more anarchistic ideas that don't really want to see the state involved. But I can't think of, again, just over the last 50 years, you know, when we did see progressive strides made in the Caribbean, in parts of Africa, in parts of Asia, you know, during the post-colonial period, we saw strides that were made by countries that ultimately were defeated from within and from without, right? They were defeated militarily. They were defeated through coup d'etat. And that's what ended that project. And so how do we expect to do the same thing in this country? We're going to redistribute wealth. We're going to change the ways in which urban budgets are distributed. And we're not going to have courts and law enforcement to penalize people who are rule breakers, right? I mean, it's almost like we believe somehow that the ruling class in this country is going to go along with the things that we want without any sort of punishment. I think the problem for us now is that we haven't lived through a period where we've seen true popular democracy, where we've seen working class ideas that are a part of the society and a part of the rule of law in a real way, right? And because we haven't seen that, a lot of us aren't really thinking about what it would be like to govern in a more just manner. And so once you're in that position, you got to think about qualified immunity. You got to think about law enforcement in a different way, right? Let me just give one quick example that might help to illustrate this. We wouldn't be sitting here, the three of us having this conversation, at least not in this format, Had it not been for a second Reconstruction in this country, that was not just about the passage of legislation, but about the enforcement of that legislation in the short term through force. And so, you know, when we get, you know, not just the Brown decision at the Supreme Court level, but the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, the Economic Opportunity Act during the 1960s, these things have to be enforced, right? It's not like Southern segregationists just were going to sit back and say, you know, fuck it. You know, let these Negroes have the hotel if they want to stay there. Give them a king size bed, right? Nobody did that. They had to be forced by the National Guard, by the mobilization of the 82nd Airborne, by the use of federal marshals, you know, the deployment. And a lot of people have this view of the 60s that erases those moments, right? Mm-hmm. And I think, again, if we're going to talk about social justice now, right, we have to think about the relationship to force. And that means the relationship to the courts and to law enforcement, right? It doesn't have to look the way that we have now. What we have now is a police, you know, apparatus that supports a highly unjust society, right? One that is super beneficial to capital, right? And I think that's what we're all opposed to. But I don't know if the alternative involves the loss or erasure of policing as a societal function. And I just haven't heard a good response. Maybe, again, somebody in your comment section might have a legit response.
They don't.
The comment section, I can see it now, so I'm trying not to. We have a situation.
Can I ask a question? Real quick.
Sure. Go ahead.
Not to be that guy, but to be that guy.
Be that guy.
Be that guy who's like, hey, when I say abolish the police, I don't really mean it. I mean, yeah. Reimagine the police.
Right.
What do you say to those people?
I mean, again, I think, you know, this is part of the consequence of, you know, echo chambers that operate both within academia, and I'm guilty of it myself. I'll admit to it. Where, you know, when we're in that space of the abolitionist, you know, networks that we might be a part of, friend circles, you know, organizations, that language makes a lot of sense, right? And it's edifying for people who are in that context. I don't deny that. I totally believe that's the case. But when you get out of that, right, how do you speak to working class people about these issues, right? Who are living in places like my hometown, which has one of the highest murder rates in the state of Louisiana now, and also has, you know, one of the highest murder rates for that matter in the country, even though it's not a place that people would think of. Say to somebody in that context that you want to abolish police or even defund the police, right? They're thinking, what are you talking about?
Right.
We need arrests being made. We need closures for these homicides, right? We don't want a rollback of police function. We need more effective policing in these communities. Now, my abolitionist friends would say, but there's other ways to get at this problem of homicide and violent crime, drug economy, and that would be through more progressive interventions. And I agree with them. But again, how do you get into that conversation with people who don't live in New York City, people who don't go to these abolitionist conferences, people who are not a part of that discourse as it exists? Get them to think about these issues in a way that closes the gap between what their real felt needs are and realities and the kind of world that you're trying to push us in the direction of, right? So I'm sympathetic at times to a number of abolitionist claims. I just don't think it makes the transition from academic and activist subculture to something that might actually become popular within the context of the United States. You can't tell people that, right? Because they're thinking, well, you know, everybody around me is saying this, right? But they're not in South Louisiana. They're not in, you know,
Oakland,
Gallup, New Mexico, right? Right.
St. Louis.
They're not in those places,
Kansas
right?
City.
Ferguson. Yeah, exactly, right? They're not in those places where There's a ground in reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know, look, I was talking on yesterday on Doug Lane's show and on Ben's show. I wanted to juxtapose the two killings of Jordan Neely and definitely of Banco Brown. Well, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Banco Brown. That's the young trans man that got murdered in San Francisco by a security guard. Mm-hmm. And in the Banco Brown case, which for whatever reason isn't really getting that much attention, which kind of makes me sad. And I think it has to do with a lot of what we're talking about here, because people, again, love the idea of white supremacy. They love even putting it in, you know, doing backflips to put it in whatever context they need for it to be true. No one here is saying that it never existed. But is it the motivational factor for people at this moment? So with the Banco Brown situation, he was a young man that was stealing in a Walgreens in downtown San Francisco. And the security guard and the company there had got orders, of course, from Walgreens that they needed to physically stop people when they saw them stealing. Because usually when you've seen those videos of people stealing and just running out and all the workers are just looking at them, it's because the store has a mandate that says if someone's stealing, you know, don't go after them.
Right.
And in San Francisco, it's been getting somewhat bad and a few people have been getting hurt. And so now security guards are armed, which I'm not the biggest fan of, you know, armed private security. I'm not that big fan of cops, but I'm not a big fan of armed private security.
Right.
So even when I was there last with my son, we saw a security guard, in my opinion, get into a very unnecessary physical altercation with an unhoused man. Mm-hmm. That multiple citizens tried to stop because no one took out their camera first. But anyway, in this Banco Brown situation, he literally gets into a fight with the security guard as he stopped. He says he's going to kill him. Security guard has a dominant position on top of him, lets him up. And Brown says he's going to stab him and kill him. Mm-hmm. Security guard tells him to leave. Brown says he's going to stab him. Security guard unholsters his weapon. You know, at that point, I don't think a cop would have unholstered their weapon.
Right.
Especially for someone that you know doesn't have anything on him. Mm-hmm. But the cops have shot people unarmed before. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like he gestured and said, I got a knife, like showed anything. He just was, you know, John. Mm-hmm. And as he's John and the guy has his weapon unholstered, he says he's going to kill him and does this move, right?
Yeah.
And it was just a gesture. Yeah. And he shot him. He spit at him. And as he spit, he shot. Mm-hmm. Now, the security guard is black. The victim is black. Mm-hmm. District attorney in San Francisco is a black woman, Brooke Jenkins, who says she is not pressing charges. She read the report, read the eyewitness statements. She put the video public. The mayor of San Francisco, also a black woman, grew up in San Francisco as well. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me that so many people have, you know, so much outrage for what happened in New York. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they're confused at how to be upset, because in the statement, because originally the security guard got taken in for murder. Mm-hmm. He was cuffed. It was a wrap for him. Mm-hmm. And the body worn cameras for the cops that took him in, as they're taking away the guy's weapons, the guy starts talking about his life. Mm-hmm. He himself experienced homelessness. Mm. I don't know if you guys know, even if you're a security guard with a gun, don't pay that much money. And the bay is expensive. He grew up with drug addicted parents. And his younger brother was murdered while sitting in a car in East Oakland. Mm. And he said in his statement, I didn't shoot this man because he stole something. I shot him because I thought he was going to hurt me. I don't know if people that suffer that level of trauma should probably, you know, be
a security
guard with a gun.
Carrying a gun, yeah.
But we also have to kind of acknowledge the fact that in some of these areas, there's legitimate trauma people suffer. And it goes back to that old Public Enemy song, you know, 911 is a joke. Ooh. That song was about the realities of when we had problems in the inner city and called the police. And I hate when people say, well, they don't stop crime. It's like, well, I know that.
Right.
The point is, we want them to find the cat that did the thing, you dummy.
Right.
And so I remember when there would be bodies hanging around neighborhoods because nobody would come. I don't know if it was like that where you grew up as well. And I guess
for sure.
But where I'm from, it'd be like, oh, you know, they didn't pick dude up for a day and he died. He got shot.
Yeah. I mean, and that's something that I think, you know, is lost. Foreman talks about that in his book, right? That especially during the Jim Crow period, but even afterwards, you know, as you're pointing out, the big problem for a lot of Black communities was the lack of service, right? Mm-hmm. The lack of response from police, the problem of over-policing, it comes much later, right? I mean, that's really, you know, with the carceral expansion of the 80s and through the Reagan-Bush period. But before that, I mean, this is part of the reason why so many different jurisdictions, you know, civil rights organizations in different cities are pushing to hire more Black cops in the 1940s, in the 1950s and 60s, because, and again, the logic now we know is flawed, right? If you hire more Black cops, they will-
They'll know the good guy.
They'll know the good guys from the bad guys, the upstanding from the ne'er-do-wells, and they will not treat Black people in the same ways, right? I mean, that was the logic that they had at the time. But again, it's coming from a place of not having enough support. I think the example you bring out from San Francisco is huge, man. I mean, you know, and this is another problem, right? So on the one side, we've got abolitionists who are saying we should end qualified immunity for police officers, which means if you shoot somebody, you're not protected. You don't get a review first before any charges are leveled against you. So there are people who are calling for that sort of thing. But something more insidious that seems to be taking shape right now, right? You've got on the one side, this vigilante culture, which is evolving, right? It's becoming much more pervasive with the spread of concealed carry in a lot of different states and the use of force that can be, you know, you can get away with it. At one point, I remember as a kid, it was like, you couldn't shoot somebody unless they crossed the threshold of your house, right? If they walk in through your door, then you can shoot them. Now that's not the case. You know, you got stand your ground laws in different states, and it allows for all sorts of behavior to take place. Another dimension of it, and this is just worth mentioning, we've got over 1 million sworn officers in this country in terms of law enforcement. And we also have about as many private security guards, right, who are not beholden. I mean, if we think the problem of sworn officers is bad, just imagine these people who are working for private security companies, and in many cases, as you point out, increasingly armed, right? I was in a grocery store close to my house last week. And I'm looking at this guy, I'm assuming he's a cop. He's got on a flak jacket. He's got on, you know, he's got a taser. He's got a gun. He's a private security guy, right? So he has as much in the way of armament as a sworn officer, but none of the legal framework around him. I mean, at least a cop has a badge. You know, there's other things.
There's someone he can answer to. Yeah.
Right. He has a ball. That may have been elected by the public, depending on the system you're in. But I just think there's new problems that are emerging right now that we need to keep pace. And again, just the perpetuation of private security, the vigilante culture that's become so normal at this point. I think those things pose serious threats.
Before we go, Cedric, I want to ask you just a couple more questions. What do you think camera has to do with some of the things we see with vigilante culture? I mean, I feel like there's certain instances where people just would have ignored stuff. But once the camera's on, everybody starts performing.
Right.
And I brought this up again, hosting Ben Burgess' show. I felt that, you know, even stepping in and stopping something from happening, sometimes people just did instinctively. I've definitely broke up my share of fights on the Bay Area Transit BART and told kids to stop fucking with certain people. Right. That's not, I didn't need a camera, you know, to do that. It's just what you did. Right. What happens again in this era of engagement? I know this might be a little drift. We're getting into a little Frankfurt schoolish drift.
Right.
from the core.
World is a stage, brother. The whole world is a stage now.
It, it feels that way. It feels that way that everybody's got to be performing for the camera, you know, negatively or positively, and nobody wants to be a quote punk for the camera. I mean, I think we showed and broke down the video of the hatchet man in the New York McDonald's that tore up that McDonald's and scared them kids. But, you know, cameras was on them, and I think that was a big reason why they felt so comfortable to hit that man.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, so the way I would come at it, I think what it's done, I think it is actually, it's a lot of those behaviors already there, right? Some of those, the same behaviors, whether it's the benevolent behavior, let me break up the fight, whether it's the person who's the bully, right? I mean, all of these things were already there. I think what it does to us, unfortunately, maybe this is taking a slightly different direction than what you're asking, it really spikes anxiety for a lot of people and sense of stranger danger, notions of agoraphobia, not in a clinical sense of somebody who's afraid to leave their house, but a social agoraphobia, you know, people who are afraid of publics, right? They're afraid of being in public spaces. And so I think when we watch those videos and, you know, if you watch one, then the algorithm is going to kick more and more of those to you, right? So after a while, you're sitting there looking at somebody getting their wig ripped off, somebody, you know, getting knocked out cold in a Wendy's, right? So there's all sorts of things that you're watching, and it's sensational. It appeals to our own, you know, sense for drama. But I think ultimately, and for people who are not really connected with working class Black people, people who are not used to inhabiting urban spaces, people who don't see the complexity of urban life, you know, in all of its fullness, it leaves us with this siege mentality, right? Which I think, again, people have already had that going back to, you know, the 1940s and 50s. You had people who were developing fears about cities and thought about cities in really dystopic ways. But I think with social media, it's really aggravated some of those sensibilities, and it can make you really scared of being in public space. And you're gonna respond in a certain way if you think that any moment anybody can attack you. I mean, right now, and there's real crime. That's the other problem, right? So I think there's a tendency for some people on the left to downplay the real crime that still exists, you know, for some of us, you know, people that inhabit certain kinds of spaces. But yeah, you know, I was on the train here, which nobody rides anymore, right? I mean, people, not nobody, but working.
No, there's a lot. There's a problem with public transportation in California. Yeah. It's a whole different show, but yes, you're right. Yes.
Yeah, but so what it's become, you know, I say in Chicago, certain lines in Chicago remain for gentrifiers, right? They tend to be packed with people going downtown to work. But there are other lines that are primarily outside of rush hour. I mean, they have become like, you know, the heroin express, right? I mean, there's so many people on who are like, I mean, I've literally seen people shooting up more than once. There's a lot of fights. Yeah, a lot of stuff going on. Yeah. Here in LA, I was on the GO line recently, and I got on. It wasn't even that late. It could have been like maybe not even midnight. And every car had at least 5 or 6 people sleeping in it, right? So it's become a mobile hotel, right? Essentially for, you know, a shelter for the unhoused. And for a lot of people who are watching those videos, they're thinking, oh, this is a dangerous space, right? Homeless people means, you know, potentially violent people. A person with a mental health condition means somebody potentially violent. In the mind of someone who is fed, overfed a diet of crazy fucking online videos, right? So that's just my take on it. But I hear what you're saying about the performative aspects, right? That people kind of take it to the next level when we're all in a reality TV series, right?
Yeah, that's how I feel every moment of the day,
right?
The era of engagement. Cedric, thank you so much for hanging out with us. I do want to ask Toussaint, you had a question that you wanted to ask before we go. I want to ask this question to you, Cedric, because I want people to know what we're going to ask you a little bit in the champagne room and also kind of tease the champagne room. You want to ask your question, Toussaint?
What question is this? Oh my gosh.
Oh my God, you're killing me.
Is it the Norman Finkelstein question?
I thought you were going to do the Chuck D iced tea question.
Okay, let's do that one.
Did you hear Cedric say, oh, God? That was good. He's going to see Chuck D on the bus tomorrow.
Here's the Chuck D question.
Let me date myself.
I got a problem with this Negro. The other day.
What are the shortcomings you see of hip-hop protest music as a protest? How did rappers like Chuck D and Ice-T in the 90s see the causes of policing similarly to BLM does today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the focus was primarily on race, right? And now, again, that's coming from, you know, the charged environment of New York City in the case of Chuck D, right, where you've got a series of different either police or vigilante killings of Black people that they're trying to respond to. But again, it's coming from that place of advocacy, right? These are the communities that, you know, Chuck D, Flavor Flav, Terminator X, you know, members of
Public Enemy
saw themselves as a part of. It's also coming from their Black nationalist ideology, right? Which sees race as the primary axis of conflict in the country. And Black people, you know, kind of in a way that's similar to contemporary Afro-pessimist type arguments, Black people can't expect whites to be legitimate allies, right? And therefore, we have to do for self, right? That was the prevailing ideology at the time. I think with Ice-T, you know, we get some of the same, maybe not in the same sort of racialized Black nationalist sensibility, but here on the West Coast, right, with the rise of you know, so-called gangster rap and, you know, the shift of attention to West Coast, we might get a little more sociology from them, right? I mean, there's more of a sense of gang culture in this part of the world and the ways in which violence unfolds for working class, young Black and Latino people in Los Angeles and, you know, throughout the Southland. So I think we get a little bit more sociology from somebody like Ice-T. But again, there's no broader analysis of the country, right? And how this is not an exceptional situation, right? This is not something that's just happening to Black people. It's actually, it may have started with working class Black and brown urban young people because of where police departments really were the largest and most powerful. But you could see it in other parts of the country. You know, you could see it in other parts of the country as well. And there's still states like Kentucky where the majority of people in prison, in the penitentiary are whites. So again, I think it's coming from a place of advocacy, right? These are people who want to do for their constituencies as they imagine them. It's not coming from a place of broad social analysis of the country as it exists. So I was all into those guys. I mean, like, again, you know, just to date myself, I was at New York as a teenager, right? I did all that stuff, right? I saw those guys in concert when I was like, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, right? So I think, you know, it was powerful then for me because it was a voice that I felt I could identify with. But, you know, as a grown man now and looking back on it, you know, there were a lot of limitations to what they were saying. You know, there were moments where they feared a conspiracy theory. There were incidents that didn't really fit the analysis that they were providing. And there certainly wasn't a strong anti-capitalist politics in any of that stuff, right?
What the hell?
At all, right? And so it took me a while. I mean, I think, you know, after that kind of, you saw how hip-hop veered more in the direction of that, you know, era of the moguls, you know, Bad Boy and Death Row and all these other big labels kind of took over. And it drained that political content out, right? That was no longer a central part of the music. It became pretty clear, right, the limitations of it, right? And a lot of it, I mean, this is another problem. A lot of it, because there was no class analysis, it settled on us just doing better, right? We need to do better, right? So you can't allow this white supreme to take you down, right? You have to live clean in the case of public
enemy. You got to be Trey from Boys in the Hood.
Right, right.
You know, that's, you got to, you know. You
right.
Work at the mall.
Yeah, you need a strong father figure in your life, right? Those things.
I will Black never love. Understand that scene where, first of all, his dad doesn't really give him a fade in the kitchen. Yeah. What 16, 17-year-old young man is gonna like, cut the hair. You know what I mean? Like, unless your dad is like the barber, which is the thing. But if your dad is just that nigga that sells real estate,
that's facts. I used to call my sons in when they were little, but at certain point,
the wall clippers from a regular ass store. He didn't even put out the fuck the shit that you get from the Korean beauty shop. When you saw that in that movie, you knew either the prop guy fucked up, or this story is all fucked off. And then he tells that weird lie for no reason.
Right.
I was like, between this and, you know, why is there no Black people on the walls?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, Boys in the Hood also is a movie I will watch so many times. Ben Burgess came in my car once and slammed the door, and I was this close to yelling at him. You slammed my door like a gorilla on the football field.
Yeah, that was, I went to I actually went to a discussion about John Singleton a few months ago here, and it just sent me off on a nostalgia trip. I didn't watch that. I was like, I can't do that to myself.
You don't want to watch. Look, but you live in
LA. But at
the
time, it was a big deal, right? At the time, I mean, think about that one scene where they're like in Compton, and he's describing gentrification to these guys, and then Grady from
Whitman Mayo comes across over here shooting and shit. What I'm gonna do for food? One smoke me. I gotta smoke me first. By the way, buy my mixtape.
Right. Right. But you know, at the time, he was like, "That's deep." You know,
bruh. There are people. There are people today that go, this is the truth. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
Of course.
That scene right there, I was like, when I grow up, I'm going to be Furious Styles.
Right. Minus the bad hair.
We ain't the ones bringing in the rock, but we selling the rock, pushing the rock. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They want us to kill ourselves. That narrative fucks it up when, like, rich Negroes that ain't from the hood come in the hood, because everybody thinks gentrification is just white people moving in and gun. I'm from Richmond, California. I don't know where the gun store is. I mean, I know where you can buy cheap booze. The ice cream man is so dope, they're acting like you just get guns willy nilly. I'm like, I saw that in the South.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Cedric.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
10 minutes later. Thank you again.
If you guys are having fun with this, Toussaint actually wrote some great questions for Cedric that I do want to address. We'll be in the champagne room. Asking him these questions. We're also going to be breaking down some rap videos from some artists I found on Instagram. That is my new thing. It's finding rappers on Instagram. I love it. And I send them to MT and ask her if we should talk about them. And she said we can. and we talked to Cedric about it a little bit before the show, and he knew one of the rappers, so this should be good. This should be a good discussion. Also, if you guys want access to the Champagne Room, it's free. There's a free trial going on right now with Patreon. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. It's as easy as that. Free trial for the Champagne Room. We will see you guys there in Tucson. Mm-hmm. We are
black.
That too.